Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host, Tom Coyne. Joining us today is a singer, a songwriter, a guy who our AOR and melodic rock crowd would know from his time in 21 Guns with Scott Gorham of Thin Lizzy fame. But he's a guy who's had some projects before that, after that. He's got a whole other career as a songwriter. We're going to talk about all that stuff. Please welcome Tommy Laverty. Hey, Tommy, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How you doing?
Good. Good. So you're a guy, and we've talked for a few minutes before we started recording here, a guy who's done...
Yeah, all the good stuff.
All the good stuff.
It's gone. Forget it. Now it's just boring stories.
I said we got to shut up and
we'll
get
talk about
the
weather now.
Yeah. It's nice out there. Yeah.
But you're a guy who's done some things in your career, but there's been a lot of long stretches between things. So I guess let's start way back in the beginning and go back to the... I guess it would be the mid-80s, and talk about a project and a band that you had, which was A440, released an album back in 1986 on Casablanca Records. Talk about how you got involved with that.
You got to say that out loud and let everybody know how old I am already.
Yeah. Yeah, but you were 12. You were 12 years old when you cut that record. Right. So.
Yeah. I was a kid. I was, and back then it was ridiculous that somebody my age was even in. It was such a different perspective towards acts and artists and things. You had to earn it. You know, the musicians were musicians. They were all, you know, music school graduates and, you know, guys playing, you know, practicing freaking things for, you know, for years inside their little rooms and dormitories or wherever the hell it was. And then I come along and I literally stepped off a plane coming back from Fort Lost in the Woods, Missouri, which is what we refer to in the Army. I had a brief stint, and by brief stint, I graduated basic training, and they have a thing called an AIT thing. It's an AIT, means Advanced Individual Training, for those that don't know. And right after that, I got into a couple fights here and there. I was kind of an angry kid, and came off the plane, generally discharged from the United States military, and walked into a place where I was too young to go into. And literally, like 5 minutes later, some guy comes up and goes, "Hey, do you sing?" And I was like, "What?" I go, "Yeah, I sing a little." You know, I didn't really. Yeah, I was in, like, you know, school bands or whatever. And he goes, "Look, I'm doing a project, and you know, I'm the guitar player for Donna Summer." And I was like, "Oh, that's great." You know, I love Donna Summer. I was a huge fan. And he, you know, she was like, what, Lady Gaga of her generation?
Sure, or absolutely.
One of the biggest acts of all time.
Yeah.
And so that was a big deal to me. You know, it just stepped right into it. Yeah, there we go. Hold on. Sorry, kids. Hold on. Yeah. I'm supposed to turn this off.
It's Josh Ramos calling in.
Sorry about that.
Josh is calling you. He heard you on our show.
Yeah, it's Josh. My phone is charged. Why aren't you including me? Why didn't you mention? The hanging upside down doing interviews. But long story short, which is impossible.
Yeah.
I meet, you know, back then you didn't know what the hell was going on. I mean, I was young. I was, you know, apparently striking at that point and appealing just visually. They had no idea what I could do musically, which for me, you know, it was like a well-kept secret, but I knew I could do it. And they asked me, you know, to come in to audition. I got the gig. Guys like Matt Bissonette, Tom Walsh, Rich Rutenberg, and Nick Brown was a guitar player at the time. And we generated enough time to to do a showcase that actually Donna set up for us.
Wow.
And because she believed so much in the project, and, you know, thankfully she believed in me. And she was a beautiful person, an absolutely beautiful person. And really, it's her damn fault that I'm in this industry. Really. So she wrote a letter to Polygram Records. I got it somewhere. Said, you know, sign this guy, sign these guys, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so I did it. And we got the record deal. And then we did a few stints here and there, and that was it. And it was very short lived, but it was a fantastic experience. And I wouldn't trade it in for anything.
Nah, Tom and I are fans of that album. I mean, have you heard
it's a terrific
the term?
Record? Yeah,
it's a very strange record, isn't it? It's very weird.
It's like, strange for its time, because like 86-ish is like everything was like really by then in the States at least was metal, you know, or you know,
story of my life, like metal. 2 years too late, years too late,
right? Because we've had a lot of artists on the show that did this type of what's now called a high tech AOR or AOR or you know. But it was more like 81, 82, 83, you know, by 84, 85, you were pushing it because everything was some form of metal, whether whether it was Iron Maiden or Rat or somewhere in between it. And as great as that record was, and I loved it, it kind of is a little bit of a throwback album. It sounds like something that was recorded more in the early 80s.
100%. Hence the reason why I didn't want to do a second record, and the same thing with 21 Guns, the exact same thing. You know, I was listening to the Police and reggae and stuff. I was more into that scene. I was, it was more of a mob thing for me. I didn't feel comfortable in that band either. Mm. And although I enjoyed it and I love the guys that were in the band, and I'm still friends with Matt to this day. It's pretty incredible. That journey was remarkable for how young I was. I didn't realize how young I was. Again, you know, looking back, you realize some things that you didn't realize then going through the experience. I was a kid. I was a baby, you know.
Now, did that project fold because it didn't sell well, or you just had no, you know, desire to do another record?
I beg your pardon. No. Yeah, it was a few things. It was the direction. They wanted to stay in the same direction after a failed record. And I would, you know, and the thing, those little goofy things, like, you know, the most important things I walk away from that stuff is, first of all, Donna Summer, the showcase, and the fact that we were the last, or at least to my knowledge, you guys probably know this better than I do, we were the last band ever to be on Casablanca Records.
Okay.
And because it shut down after that, or they just went on to some other kind of form of label, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But holding that record, that vinyl record, with seeing the band's name with the Casablanca logo over the top, you know, to me that was like magical, because I was a kid growing up listening to Kiss and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And that record was so symbolic to me, and that's really, you know, that's what I got from it. That was it, you know, and a little bit of life experience, and then see you later.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you talk about a guy like Matt Bissonette, went on to play with his brother in David Lee Roth's band. Elton John, he played with Rick Springfield over the years. So
would you stop rubbing it in? I know. he called. It's funny. I'll go off track a little bit, but you know, there was a time in my a couple of years ago where I was doing Vegas, right? And I had this concept or blah 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 blah. I'm going in and I start working Vegas, and I'm doing the hotels and all that shit, and I'm loving it. I'm loving it because I'm playing an Italian-American character, Tony Cardoni, you know, in the new swing generation. We're playing music like, you know, modern music, Bohemian Rhapsody and swing band arrangement, right? And it was starting to go quite well. And all of a sudden I get a call from Matt Bissonette. And he goes, hey, man, what are you doing? What's going on? How you been? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm playing Vegas. He goes, oh, yeah, me too. He goes, I'm like, oh, yeah, what are you doing? He goes, Elton John, you know? Ever heard of him? You know, and I'm and what are you doing? I heard, are you playing Vegas? No, I'm just you know, chilling out. You know, it's the levels, it's just remarkable.
And his brother was, or probably still is, Ringo's drummer for forever.
That's right.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, I think, you know, I remember correctly, his brother, Greg, who another character, love him to death. He auditioned for A440 and didn't get the gig.
Really?
Oh, really?
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know?
He's been with Ringo for years.
Not to say that Tom wasn't a great drummer. I mean, Tom was Tom, you know.
Yeah.
Also a good guy from back east as well.
Hmm. Okay.
Now, basically, when that project folded, the A440, how did you get involved with Gorham, and how did that 21 Guns project come about? Because it's like about a 5 or 6 year spread of time in between each one.
Yeah, I went back to California, and I became that surfing, cliche, stereotypical California dude with the long hair and the curly. I look like Jeff Spicoli from Fast Times at Richmond High. And I was that person. That was the character I was then. And I was at the beach every single day. I mean, you know, I'd drive my Chevy van with the fucking curtains and the plush carpet in the back and a couch and everything. And I remember the back of the couch was filled with sand. And so after a while, I just kept putting sand in there. So the bottom of it was all sand when you came in.
Like a sandbox on wheels.
It was fantastic. If I could do it again, I would do it, you know, with trees and shit. You know, I'd overdo it.
Put a palm tree back there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I was in my van, and somebody came out. I was staying in an apartment in Malibu. Off and on, I was coming in because a friend of mine owned this huge piece of property that was right over this place called Point Dune, which is since a lot more famous than it was back then. And it was like a little. It's a picturesque, beautiful coastline of California. It's a gem. And I would spend my days there. That's what I would do. And then, you know, I go up and crash with him. And he comes out of the house and he goes, "Hey, somebody's calling for you." And I'm like, "What? Someone's calling for me? How'd they get your number?" He goes, "I have no idea. He goes, come on in." So I'd come in, you know, and I got my shirt off and my hair and, like, you know, sand all over the place. And I'm walking in and I'm like, "Hello." And it was this guy, Leif Johansson. And Leif Johansson was the bass player for A-ha, Take On Me fame.
Sure. Oh, yeah. No, I'm a big fan of those guys. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm waiting for you to go, uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And no, of course. You know who they are.
And which, you know, another ridiculous set of circumstances is who would have thought 25, 30 years later that when I was a kid opening up for A-ha, looking at these weird kind of foreign dudes that spoke this strange little language, that I would end up living in Norway and married to his ex-wife and raising his kids.
Oh.
So for the last 25 years, I have lived the full circle. And Morten's a part of my life. He's a part of our, you know, the kids and everything else. And it's unbelievable to me that even took place. But Leif was the bass player for that band when we opened up for them on the whole upper side of America and Canada.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "Hey man, I remember you from the tour. Do you remember me?" And I, sure.
Yeah.
You know? And I had no idea. And I was like, "Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I think I do remember you." He goes, "Yeah, but listen, we're starting a band with Thin Lizzy, and you know, and like every other idiot in, at least in California, it was like, you know, Boys Are Back in Town, you know, that was it."
Yeah.
You know, for us, I had no idea. I had no idea how big they were and how deep and thick their legacy is and how, you know, how they really influenced all of fucking rock and roll.
Oh, yeah.
At one stage.
Because they never really cracked the American market the way they did in
Europe. Isn't that ridiculous?
Right. They opened for a lot of big bands, and that's pretty much as far as they got. They opened for Queen one year, but they never cracked the American market. They were huge in Europe, but not in America.
So I was so completely out of touch with it, you know?
That was very common with Americans. A lot of Americans had no idea of all the albums they put out, all the great guitar players that were in and out of that band until after the band broke up. in the mid 80s.
After John Sykes,
right. Then people started to realize in the States, wow, there was Chinatown. I never knew about this album and that album. And you look at their back catalog, they're one of the greatest bands of all time. Hands down.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. Later I became such a huge fan. I got kind of geeky around Scott, and he was like, "Hey, man, calm down." And because it was remarkable. And I kept saying to him, I go, do you guys realize that you guys did this before Uriah Heep? You did this before, Black Sabbath. You did this, the guitar thing before Kiss. I was a huge Kiss fan when I was a kid. And, the whole sound was extremely close to Thin Lizzy. It's amazing how much they inspired, not just the dual harmony guitar stuff, but just the overall vibe, the shuffles and the swings and it's pretty remarkable.
Oh, the drummer, Brian Downey, was tremendous. Like, people don't realize pretty how remarkable. Good that guy was.
He was remarkable. Yeah. He was, I'm a huge drummer guy. I love drummers. And for whatever reason, maybe it's the pent up frustration, mm-hmm. And I have no rhythm. I'm like, I got nothing. And so I've always admired drummers. And, Keith Moon was another brilliant nut job that was just incredible. And Brian Downey was a little bit more like focused Keith Moon in a way, because he was sporadic and he was loose, but he was still
very loose. He had a lot of swing to his playing, yet had a big fat sound also.
Incredible.
Yeah.
An amazing band. I mean, that band was just crazy. And Phil and everything. And the story Scott would yarn,
imagine. Yeah. Because, Scott was a mainstay. I mean, Scott was always the guy that was there. They went through Gary Moore and Snowy White and Brian Robertson and John Sykes. But Gorham was always there.
So, I didn't know the weight of all of that until later. And so when somebody goes, yeah, Scott Gorham's band, Lizzie, I was like, yeah, whatever. A free ticket to London, I'm in.
Right.
So for the first time in my life, I went to Europe. And I think Scott came down first. That's right, he did. He came down to California. Scott's from Glendale.
Yeah.
No, I know.
Yeah, I knew he was in California.
And him and I immediately hit it off. I mean, I walked because I didn't have a car. I walked from where I was. I was somewhere around Burbank or some shit. And I walked up this freaking hill, like a Universal, that area called Universal Studios, like that kind of area, mm-hmm. Studio City.
Okay.
And I go up and I have a suit jacket on with no shirt on underneath. And these glasses, these exact glasses. No, but
that's very Miami Vice, that look.
Yeah. Back in it was still cool back then. I could still get away with it. And I knocked on the door. Scott opened the door and he started to laugh. He looks at me like and he kind of like in so many ways said, "You're the guy." I get it. You know what I mean? Like immediately.
Mm.
And of course, you didn't hear me sing yet or sing the material that they had. They played me some other stuff. And this guy named Keith something or other, I can't remember who sang with them. They did some kind of weird prog rock thing, Phenomena or whatever it was.
Oh, yeah.
You guys know
Keith,
about that?
Keith Morrell.
Keith Morrell, yeah.
There you go.
Right.
So he was the original singer. And apparently he wasn't. They wanted a little bit of a rougher edge or whatever. And I had never sang in that genre ever. I just knew I could scream. I could scream, with it came from somewhere.
Mentioned Phenomenon, and Leif Johansson was all over those Phenomenon albums.
Yeah. There you go.
He was.
So yeah. the link is complete.
Yeah. You know?
And Jesus Christ, what the hell was our drummer in Mike?
Sturgis? Mike Sturgis?
Michael Sturgis.
Mike was involved in that as well.
Yeah.
Yes, he played drums in Phenomenon.
Guys already kind of bonded.
They used to do these projects where they'd have all these like all-star singers, John Wetton was on it, Glenn Hughes, Ray Gillen.
Right.
They're actually really good albums. I don't know if you ever heard them. And Keith Morrell was part of it too.
I really like Keith's voice. I was like, when he was hitting those fucking notes. I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can do that. I can't do that. And my voice blew out. I was still wet behind the ears. I had I had no idea what I was doing. It was all natural. Whatever it came. That's why my face would always get so red on stage, and I would veins would be popping out here and there because I had no control of it. I would just let it out. Mm. It was a form of therapy for me, for sure. Yeah.
So this project commenced.
And it's done so well now.
Yeah.
This project commenced what year? Because the album didn't come out until like 92-ish.
I think it was 92, yeah.
Yeah.
We were dinking around for almost like 6 years. No, was it 6 years? I don't know. Whatever the time frame is, it was a long time. And I remember there was always a promise because the whole concept was that I was going to go there, I was going to audition, get the gig, and then once I got the gig, then we were going to release a record. But the problem is that we didn't have a record deal. And Scott didn't want to do some kind of half-baked shit, and he wanted, like, a major label or whatever. And the pickets were a little slim, and we only had, I think, like a 3-song demo. I could be completely wrong in all this, so, if anybody fact-checks me, please, I'm sorry. I'm just doing it on recall. And I was there for I think 4 years. Wow. before we got a deal.
So that dates back into the late 80s.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think it was like 89 or something like that. Wow. that I went to London. Yeah.
Wow.
This was like
the creation of a Boston album where you waited the better part of a decade for it to take fruition.
Yes. I was a kid. I was 22 years old.
Yeah, you were just along for the ride. Yeah.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Everything was fucking paid for. I was getting money. It was remarkable in those terms. It was the best time ever to be in England. It was before all the monitoring, all the cameras, all mm-hmm. And it was again, like we were saying earlier about New York, it's lost its soul a little bit, And back then there was soul, and you could feel it on the streets.
Yes.
When you went to Covent Garden, it was lively and it was bizarre. It was like everything was theatrical. It seemed like it was a play. Yeah. It was so amazing to be a part of it. Really, very lucky.
I mean, that album, I mean, even though it came out in 92 and it obviously you said it was a long time in the making, but it was something that was in 92, obviously the scene, at least here in the States, was totally changing by that point. So it was just a timing thing, I think, with that. But I would, that's definitely considered, like, amongst guys who are into like AOR and melodic rock and stuff, that's a classic album, that debut. Salute.
Thank you. Again, I walk away with the experiences, that was an amazing experience, a beautiful, wonderful relationship with Scott and life as well. The whole band really, yeah. But it was such a wonderful experience all the way up until the second record. And it was, again, my resistance to the project was ultimately the death of it. Mm. Or at least the death of it's in an existing form with me as the lead singer.
Right.
It wasn't difficult. It was a really easy decision because it just wasn't my gig. It was my gig for a while. And then I moved on. Mm. The sense of brotherhood and the loyalty that I had towards those guys will always remain. I mean, I'll do any project they want me to do, but I just at that time, and it wasn't like, oh, I'm better for this. I'm this, I'm that, and the other, I was just like, yeah, I'm kind of done with it. I'm, it's as far as I can go. And some of the early stuff that we did for the second record came out. Life released it without saying a word. How you doing, Life? And he just put it out there. And it was demos of us in this freaking farm in Wales. We rented out this huge farm. We were in this barn house. And this woman, she was running like a horse farm and everything. And again, these are the things that I walk away with these projects. They're not necessarily creative. They're more experience, right?
Yeah.
And she comes in and she wakes me up at 4 a.m. because I told her I'd want to be there when one of the horses gives birth. And, 20 minutes later, I'm pulling out a freaking colt out of a horse I've never met before inside this, confined space of a stable, and yanking it, and it was magical. It was, and that was the best part of that entire trip. because some of the songs we were trying to get a little bit rougher because I was more into Chili Peppers, and they were like, I want to keep it a little bit more like this, more like that.
Yeah.
We did a cover of Baby, I'm Amazed at the Way You Love Me All the Time. Mm. Which I thought was great. I thought that was a great cover. And then someone just recently just did it, but it was a cool rock version of it. I don't know if it was on the demo thing. I think he called it Demolition.
Demolition. I came out, I think, 2002, which was good. Yeah. I guess the would be second album that you're talking about.
So all those songs were recorded on like a little 8-track McGee that was like inside this barn in Wales.
Wow.
I think we're there for a month and it rained every fucking day. Every day it rained. I couldn't believe it.
So there was a second album, the second album that was actually put out as 21 Guns. Those were songs that you didn't have anything to do with. That was done with a different singer, obviously. I believe it was a guy named Solly.
He lives here. He lives here in Norway.
He was in a band I really liked a lot called Sons of Angels.
Great. Yeah. And he is the sweetest guy on earth. He's the nicest guy. And, it was kind of weird because our paths would cross here in Norway. And I was just happy that they were doing something. I just wanted the best for that project, the best for those guys. And that was it. There's a part of me that is so musical and ambitious when it comes to music, but there's also the other side of me that could just lay on my back and drink a margarita on the beach and never leave. And I battle with those sides of myself all the time, because I find so much peace and so much serenity in the woods, in the forest, by a river, by a lake, by the ocean. It's my gig. That's the essence of who I am. So I was always struggling with it, with no matter how good the bands were, no matter how great they were. And that's why a lot of these guys went on to go do other things. And I kind of just went back into, underneath the Wizard of Oz curtain, and I just started writing music. And I got lucky. Mm. I got lucky. It's a numbers game. I was throwing songs out there, a couple landed, and financed a few things, got some record, some publishing deals, and then it started to blow up a little bit, and it was nice,
Well, we're going to get to that because of what you're doing currently, but I guess after that kind of fizzled out, was there something you wanted to add to that, or because I was going to say it many years later?
Yeah, I mean, well, how did you get pulled into the Frontiers Music Vortex?
Yeah, 2014, you do the LRS project, Laverty, Ramos, Shotton. Josh Ramos and Michael Shotton, we had on as guests on our podcast over the last year or so, Michael Shotton more recently. But yeah, like Tom was saying, how do you, many years goes by, salute, early 90s, and then boom, 2014. How do you get pulled back into
that thing? Was 2014? That's already 10 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like we were talking about the whole Italian thing. It's like in the mafia, once you're in, you can't get out, right? They pull you back into that melodic rock thing.
But in a way, it's funny you bring
especially
that up.
With Frontiers, I mean, they're all,
I was just gonna
they're,
say,
they're all
I was
Goombas just gonna over
say,
there.
I was going to say that it's funny you bring those two up at the same time. But it was one of those things. It was, again, like I said earlier, and I don't want to say it out too loud because my daughter's here now, but, I was saying no to everything,
But how does a guy with the last name Laverty say no to the Goombas at Frontiers?
Not a chance in hell that was going to happen. Again, the experience, right? Like, do you want to come to Milano? And I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And I literally have family in Toscana, so for me that was really the biggest reason why. Because I was going to go to Italy. I was going to have some experience. I was going to live there kind of amongst, the natives and live it. Mm. And that was what I was after. And, the songs, although not my cup of tea, I liked it. I had fun. I had so much fun. It was, and my wife was right. You know, it was say yes. What is it going to hurt?
Now that project, I'm just, you know, because I re-listened to this album yesterday and I have my own, you know, opinions on it. I'll share with you, but I want to get your opinion first. Did they kind of push you guys in a direction or did you, the three of you, have a sound that you wanted to have captured?
I'll probably get a lot of shit for saying this, but it's, I'm actually doing the Josh Ramos thing. I'm not going to say anything, but that guy's a shithead. Right. I'm like, I don't want to say anything, but everything's fucked up and life sucks.
Other than that, everything's great.
Exactly. Serafino wanted to make a Journey record.
I said this before we
said it sounds like Journey outtakes.
I said the whole album sounds like Journey B-sides and Journey outtakes. And it didn't do justice to the three guys. And I don't know how they didn't have you and Shotten sing some songs together. That was the other thing.
You know, I was pushing for Mike because Mike had a demo of a song. And I think it was the, I think it's called I Can Take You There or something like that. Mike had written that song and the original demo was him singing it. And I was like, what the fuck, Mike? I mean, Jesus Christ, why don't you sing this song? I don't want to sing your song. You should do it. And, you know, I could tell there was, maybe I'm speaking for him out of place or whatever, but I could tell there was a part of him that kind of, I kind of agreed, you know?
I think he's a lead singer. I mean, yeah, and a damn good one.
And he's great.
Yeah.
That's the
right.
thing.
It's, right. It's like that's why I was blown away that there was, I remember when I bought the album when it first came out and to see that he was not listed, I thought for sure there was at least going to be a few songs that the two of you co-sang and that he was just relegated to the drums.
Woulda, coulda, shoulda, you know, and I even said, like, if we do a second record, man, you got half take half, I'll take the other half. And, you know, maybe we could do a duet.
Well, that too, you know, I mean, you know, that was, I thought was very odd, but it was funny. That's why I wanted you to say it first before I said it, because honestly, I was disappointed in the record for the three guys that were on it. I thought it should have been a little more rocking and a little heavier.
I wanted, to no fault of anyone involved in it. It was a project. It was a brainchild of a guy who loves Journey, who saw a door to kind of grab some of that for himself. And Alessandro is, you know, he's a talented, multifaceted freaking, you know, he wrote almost every song on the record like in a week or some shit.
Yeah, Alessandro Del Vecchio, yeah.
And he just pumps it out.
Yeah.
And he sits there and he pumps it out. And, you know, it's got a little bit of a push.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Especially at that period of time, if you go back to Frontiers 10, 12, 14 years ago, in that time period, they were so obsessed with Journey. And they were so obsessed with the guy Hugo.
And that's totally fine.
The singer Hugo. Yeah, I mean, that sang in the band Valentine. They put out so many albums that it all sounded like, you know, B-sides and outtakes of Journey albums. And this album became that, unfortunately, because it should have been, with you three guys, it should have been a lot more than it was, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, I 100% agree. You said it better than I could. And with less words and a thicker accent. And it's I think that that kind of direction to me, it's kind of what happened when I got into the swing band thing. And I didn't want to do just swing. It's been done a million times. I mean, imagine the guys, you know, the boys, you know, I got them over here on the wall. I'll show it to you later, but it's dealing with the idea that their form of music had fallen. Because at one point, you know, it was over, you know. Guys like Frank Sinatra, who ruled the roost, you know, like, and was in complete control. And in my family, you know, there was a picture of Mother Mary and a picture of Frank Sinatra, and my family prayed to Frank Sinatra more than Mother Mary. You know what I mean?
I saw Frank Sinatra too. Did you ever see Frank Sinatra?
What's that?
I saw Frank Sinatra.
Did you?
Yeah, 1982 at the
Philharmonic. Oh my God! I
took my mother.
In a second.
I took my mother. My mother went through a terrible divorce with my wonderful father, and I did it for her as a gift. I 1982.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, he was a genius. He was his phraseology. I mean, that's the admiration that I have for some singers. Steven Tyler is one of them. I'm a huge fan. Partly he is responsible for me being a singer at all. Not in any way personal circumstance, but just by me idolizing him and being inspired by him. And I remember having an 8-track tape with Toys in the Attic. And you remember this? I don't know if you guys remember the mono speaker with the 8-track that came out, and it had a push down thing that would switch the tracks.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I had that duct tape to my skateboard when I was a kid on the front, and I'd go through the neighborhood with that fucking thing blasting through that mono speaker. That was my life, you know. And it's so funny because the same with Frank Sinatra, same all those guys, and even Aerosmith, you know. Their legacy, as long and as, you know, heavy as it is, it's bizarre to think that if you came out with an Aerosmith record now, no one would give a shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And of course, diehard fans and people, true, you know, the things. And it's kind of scary just to see a form of music, you know, kind of die.
Yeah.
But it lives on through you guys. It lives on with these kind of projects. It lives on through frontiers. It lives on, you know, there's something to be said with that because it touches people.
Mm.
And when I was in Milan and we did the thing for LRS, the festival thing, those people were genuinely fucking happy. They come up to me, you know, they were touched, you know, and it made me cry. I was actually crying on stage. It was pretty emotional and real, you know, and you can't discount any kind of music like I used to. I used to be a little bit more, you know, a little bit mean, a little bit more stern towards it's dead. It's a dead form of music. Who's doing that anymore? And in some ways, that kind of mentality kind of kept me alive in the industry that I'm in now. And, you know, I'm already a fucking dinosaur among 25, 23-year-old songwriters that are writing pop songs, and I got to get it or I'm out.
Mm.
You know, I got to either adapt or go.
Yeah.
You know? And it's a different industry now, but it's always the same shit, right? There's always a reason why this doesn't happen, that doesn't happen. Right. Oh, you can't get a song played on MTV if the radio's not playing it. Mm. You can't get MTV to play it if the radio, you know, it's all the same shit, right? And now it's just like Spotify. There's just many different reasons.
Well, you were talk about that because you did the LRS thing in 2014, but you have been a songwriter for a long time, obviously being over in Europe now, and you're in kind of the pop industry, right? You've done a lot of K-pop writing and different things.
Yes, for I have. Yes.
Pop artists. Was that something you were doing prior to 2014 and then continued since then?
I believe it started right around when my beautiful daughter, Savannah, was born. 2005 is when it started to kind of kick.
Okay.
I had a few number ones before that in Norway. And, you know, I have a stack of freaking platinum and gold records, but I think I made like $25. You know what I mean? So it is what it is in comparison or whatever. But
yeah,
at one point I had three songs in the top 10 with three different artists, and it was taken off. It was doing its thing, and it was all pop music. Yeah. It was and really pop music, like goofy kind of. But I loved it. It was a side of me that was unleashed, you know. You know, it was a talent that I kind of just kind of stumbled into. I still to this day don't play an instrument. I pick up a guitar and everybody waits for me to play something, and I'm like, you know, I can't do anything. Or piano, same thing. The melodies, they just, thank God they still come. They come on walks. They come in the bathroom, and you know. You know, walking my dog, it's remarkable, really, that anything gets paid for. It's unbelievable. It is.
Well,
thank
I mean,
you, Frankie.
When you get into that pop side of things in the pop industry, I mean, as a songwriter, I mean, that's where it's at, you know?
Yeah. But again, no, especially the music industry, it doesn't come without struggle, secret handshake bullshit. Mm-hmm. You know, the clicks and the production teams and the backstabbing and the bullshit, it's all there. And it's, you know, it's a big fucking hefty bowl of shit. Mm. And you either, you know, put up with it, put up with the smell and bat the flies away and just plow right through it. Or you know, you give up. Mm. And I don't have give up in me. I just never did. And that, I mean, says a guy who quit two bands. Sorry about that. Except for that.
Well, if the opportunity ever presented itself, and maybe you were given a little bit more artistic free rein, would you come back into
artistic
the melodic?
Or artistic?
Would you come back to the melodic rock scene at all to do an album?
You know, I have a big problem with my off switch when it comes to being honest, right? It's gotten me in trouble quite often. And so my answer to you, as honest as it is from the center of my being, is everyone's a whore. I would whore myself gladly for another record. Absolutely. And I know it kind of belittles and it kind of almost puts it in a kind of a category of it's true to me that I would enjoy the experience of a new record of doing something like that. And to be honest with you, I would have to find a reason to do it. And the funny thing was, it wasn't an astounding amount of money that I got from LRS. I did it for a friend of mine. He probably doesn't even know it, but he's a fan of this genre and he is a dedicated, loyal Kiss fan. His name is Lars Savongen. And when I did it, he was so happy and so proud and, you know, and he listens to it religiously, that record. And we're out in the boat, we're fishing and he's playing the fuck out. I'm like, yeah, turn that shit off, you know? And it's a little game we play back and forth. And part of me would be like, oh, don't turn it off. It's kind of nice. You know, it's nice that I can still hit those notes, you know? And that's the thing with this thing, like every fucking thing else, your hair, your teeth, your looks, gravity catches up and we all become, you know, these parodies of ourselves that we once were. And you know, I would gladly do it and I would do it under the circumstances that I enjoyed it. Like I did the first record. LRS was fantastic. I can't imagine doing it with Frontiers because I pissed off Serafino.
But you're not the only one.
No, it's, you know, business is business, right? Like you guys either see eye to eye and, you know, I, like I said, we're all whores, but you know, up to a point, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It you can only do so much before you just, you know, I would have to get something out of it. And, you know, some people that are less cynical than I am would say, oh, you don't do it for the art. You don't do it. Look, if I was doing this for the art, I'd stay in my fucking house and I'd write songs and stay to myself forever. And you wouldn't hear me once. I also do art. I draw, and I, you know, it's a masterpiece to me, and that's enough. But if I need someone else's, you know, pat on the back, then I have to accept the terms of that, like we all do. Like, you know, this is a weird business. We're in a very strange thing to be an artist, to want to be seek everyone's approval, but yet not need it at all, and then or be so codependent on it. Can't even face the fact that you've lost it all.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's some singers out there now, you're just like, please, for God's sake, just fucking quit.
Yeah.
Would you? Yeah. Just give it up, man. You know, let it go. You had your day in the sun, more so than most people.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm not mentioning names, but David Lee Roth is one of them. Like, there's my Josh Ramos moment.
There you go.
And you know what?
I don't want to mention names.
There's worse than him. That's just starting with it.
Yeah.
There's guys out there even worse.
I remember, and I'm getting myself in trouble. I remember when Bissonette, he used to go and play at this place called Pelican's Retreat. And Pelican's Retreat was almost like the Kit Kat Club or fucking CBGBs of California, right? Mm-hmm. Like the California version, you know? But it was more, you know, like Pelican's Retreat. It was more like a beachy kind of, you know, Cabo Wabo maybe, you know? And everybody who was anybody played there. And some amazing people would go through there. And the patrons had no fucking idea. And I was waiting tables at that place while Matt was, who was, you know, in A440. So after A440, I was waiting tables there. And he was coming there to play. Mm. So he would have me come up and sing all the time. And so, you know, and everyone's like, what the fuck are you doing here, man? You could be a singer, you know, all that shit. And it was great. I loved it. I loved that whole experience. But Bobby Kimball came up and, you know, he looked like he had a powdered donut for breakfast. Let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, whatever happened, happened. And I thought to myself, you know, if that ever fucking happens to me, please, like I tell my daughter, you know, look, if I start forgetting things too much, or if I, you know, if I start drooling on myself in the corner, do me a favor. Just put me in a fucking boat with all my fishing gear and make me think I'm going on a fishing trip and just push me out. And wait, I'll be the happiest guy on earth and I wouldn't know the difference. You know what I mean? And I think everybody has their day. And, you know, maybe I've had mine. Maybe songwriting wise, you know, that was it. I don't know. You know, you're only as good as your last song. And it's been, you know, a year since something significant has happened. So that's the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering. Yeah.
You know, I do.
You guys ask questions.
I do think there's a demand for your voice because the 21 Guns album has definitely left an indelible mark on the melodic scene. And it's still talked
about. Well, I got news for you. I demand that voice too, my friend. I don't know if I got that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, only you could speak to that.
To be quite honest.
Yeah. You know? I mean, the vocals on that album were, you know, stupendous. I don't know if you still have that in you, but if even something close, there's a market for it.
I got, probably just out of stubbornness, you know what I mean? I would do it. Just out of gumption, I would attempt it. But, you know... few packs here and there back in the day. I don't do that anymore, but I, you know, I'm on that stupid goofy vape thing. You know what I mean? It's like, you think you're cool until you put one of those freaking things in your mouth.
Right.
And, time takes its toll. I don't do drugs. I got rid of that from all my teens, my early teens, and just about up until I was 20, I was, you know, on like 4 tabs of acid a day. You know what I mean? Like, I was doing some serious shit. Never got into the smack child like Scott did, and he told me millions of horror stories, and he suffered his whole life because of it. So I'm very fortunate, and I've still got my physicality and my adolescent brain. So yeah, why not? You know, I'd give it a shot.
Okay.
You know? I mean, Scott got propped up for a while by John Sykes. I mean, John, you know, put the Lizzie thing back together and had him out on the road for quite a while, and they did good with that.
You know, again, Scott is—he's one of my idols. He just is. No,
he's an iconic figure, and there's no other way to put it. He's.
I mean, he's what they are, almost what Spinal Tap is parroting.
Yes.
You know? They were. Those are the kind of stories that come out of Scott. It's just, you know, I just sit there and, you know, just tell us another story, Uncle Scott. Yeah. You know, he's got so many, and they're genuine. You know, I'll give you a quick one. We were sitting in his house in Putney in London. I was maybe 20, 21 years old or whatever. And he's on the phone. He's like, yeah, I know what you mean, man. All right. Okay. Yeah. And they're bullshitting. They're laughing and stuff like that. And he goes, okay, Pete, I'll talk to you later. Bye. And, you know, he hangs up. And I don't know if you guys are, you know, whatever, but The Who was one of the biggest bands in my life. I love that freaking band. And he was like, I go, who? Pete who? He goes, Pete Townsend. What are you doing?
Wow.
And I'm like, you're just like bullshitting with Pete Townsend? This is crazy. And we still don't have a record deal? What the fuck is wrong? Right. I couldn't get it. You know, he was hobnobbing with everybody. Anybody. So I took it as a great compliment that he wanted me as his lead singer. Believe me, at first I didn't, because I was like, hey, everybody loves me. But he, the fact that I found out, you know, as we were getting ready to make the record, that I was honored enough to be in his presence and to share stage with him, I was grateful and humbled, greatly humbled.
Wow.
I think that's a part of it. You know, you get an SD, singer's disease, you know?
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot of them come and go and seen them fall. And some would probably accuse me of that because of the fact that I left a couple bands here and there. But I've always been as open as I possibly could be to any new experience, anything. You know, I'll try it. Why not? you know, especially, you know, musically, you know, I'm doing EDM for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
And any, you know, God loving, respectful musician wouldn't dare to embrace some of the shit that comes out of it. I love it.
Right. Right.
I freaking love it. It's, and if you concentrate hard enough, you can get your rock influences and your Aerosmith out in an EDM song. It's just replacing the instruments. That's all it was for me. It was a simple replacement of the live drums for a freaking, you know, a drum machine, right? It happened early in the 80s. You remember when the fucking drum machines came out? It was like, what, sure. Crazy?
Yeah.
I'm not touching that fucking thing. You know, it was sacred. Back then, it was sacred to be a musician. Not so much anymore, especially if you can go on AI and make a song in fucking 30 seconds.
And then there was a period of time in the mid-80s where the drum machine was cool, like, you know, and then guys really fucked 100%. Up good rock records by using them.
Oh, my God.
I remember Gary Moore used it on one of his albums. I was a Gary Moore nut. And I'm like, it's a fucking drum machine. Like, what is he thinking? Yeah. But it was like that 85, 86 period. It was like, it was cool if you used a drum machine, but it sounded like shit. And you go back to those records and great hard rock records. And
but what did you really think about it?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I'm from Brooklyn, you know. I'm like you. I got the Italian thing. You wear your emotions on your sleeve, you know.
100%. And, you know, it's funny how all these things evolve. But to me, as a creator, it is very interesting to me how all these things we fear at the beginning end up being one of our major tools that we use to create, right? And, you know, autotune is a perfect example. Nobody would use autotune when I was doing it. When we did the record with Chris Lord-Alge, you can ask him. I did, you know, 1,000 freaking takes. And he did comps of, like, you know, if and, you know, and after breaths and shit. I mean, it was a true compilation. I'm not a one-take wonder by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, that motherfucker worked to get the vocals on 21 Guns. And he did an amazing job. And shout out to Chris. I miss you, brother.
The production on that album is tremendous. Oh, yeah. The overall production is really, really good.
That was a great experience. That was such a great experience.
The separation and the
nuance.
Yeah, it had that real heavy drum sound. And the overall production on that was great.
And imagine, look what he continued to do. You know, he went on and started to influence the current form of music after working on a record that essentially had seen its time before it was even done. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. That's the truth of the matter. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. But we had a blast recording it. We did most of that at Steve Vai's house.
Oh, okay.
In Lindero Canyon or Lindero. No, the Hollywood Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was an experience within itself. Steve Vai coming in, listening, and, you know, hanging out, and then leaving, you know. And I'm like, is that who I fucking think he is? You know. And what's funny is that he didn't remember that I was the same motherfucker. And excuse my French. I apologize.
That's fine.
That's fine.
My daughter's probably getting very upset that she said no cussing when you do the interview. And so I go to this party, and Matt and had just gotten the gig. With Steve Vai, and you know, Greg and everybody, you know, we're hanging out, and they're all watching this thing, and they're all standing around, and they're watching this video, and I'm like, what is it, fucking porn or something? What's going on? And I go and I take a look, and I go, what is this? Steve Vai looks over at me, he goes, never seen him before. I didn't even kind of know who he was, to be quite honest. And he turns over and he looks and he goes, Led Zeppelin, you asshole. And that was it. That was my experience with Steve Vai. And then later, years later, I'm in his fucking house feeding his vegan dog meat. And he's like, I don't understand why your dog loves you so much. He never loves anybody that much. Yeah, just try giving him a fucking burger. What do you think the difference is?
Yeah, really?
His dog was a vegan.
Really?
Very sweet man. Extremely gracious. Just a great experience to be surrounded by people like that. I do a lot in my life to try to forget the assholes, you know, because There's so many of them. Hmm. It's, you know, when I met Roy Thomas Baker, I thought it was like praising him, you know, but he was an asshole, you know, like, and he may not be an asshole to anybody else, but to me particularly, he was an asshole, you know, and those are that's the thing. You leave yourself with people, the impression, you know, my grandfather was one of the most loving people on earth. And I see him as a noble, beautiful man that shaped my entire view towards fishing and nature. But he was an asshole when he was younger. He beat the shit out of his kids. Mm. He was an alcoholic, you know, at one point. And it's incredible to think that beautiful man, that one that I idolized, also had another side to him.
Right.
Mm. You know, and what? He came from a different generation. He was an immigrant. You know, his freaking name's on, you know, Ellis Island or some shit. And it is the way it is, you know. We give certain parts of ourselves at certain times to people. And at those times, in those bands, I was a really good version of myself. And I hope that I left that side of me with those people. And that's what they carry. And records are the same. The same with LRS, the same with 21 Guns and A440. I was that guy when I was doing it. And I had a great time doing it.
Yeah.
And I hope people are left with that. And in some cases, they really are. I get fan mail to this day. It's remarkable to
me. Sure.
It's remarkable.
And that applies to everything in life, really. I mean, I go back now. I'm 66. I look at different things in my 30s, in my 20s, my 40s. And I say to myself, wow, I'm glad I'm not that guy anymore. You know, and I'm sorry I was at that period of time. But at that period of time, it seemed perfectly acceptable to be that guy.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what you do.
And I look back at it and I say, wow, I was a real fucking asshole. But I was very comfortable being an asshole then.
100%. To me, it was all about women. And how, you know,
yes, unfortunately for me too. Yes.
Yeah. And they, you know, they said you can't fuck them all. And I was like, oh, yes.
Yes. That was my mentality also. That's why I'm divorced.
I can most certainly make a valiant effort.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I did, you know, I lived it, you know, I lived it. I looked like it. I was it, you know, but you know, I'm not that guy at all.
And don't you feel like you're a better person? I know I do. I feel I'm much, much more peace with myself on a daily basis. Not being that person.
I miss the daring aspect of who I was. I miss the chance risk taking guy.
I do on certain days, but you know, I also I'm 8 years older than you. So get back to me when you're 66.
But the old cliche, you know what I mean? It's like you are what you think you are and all that shit.
Yeah.
I mean, you are how you feel and whatever. I feel like a kid. I still do.
I do too. I almost to a detriment because I really do forget how old I am. You know,
And responsible things like, you know, taxes and bills and the real things.
Right.
And you know, should I go on tour or should I, you know, support my daughter's musical theater?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like you gotta balance out what's important. But, you know, like in California, I would spend, you know, 12 hours a day, and I'm not even overstating it, 12 hours a day in the ocean, just diving all over the freaking place. And when I moved back to California, I was like, I'm going to get back into it again. I'm going to go snorkeling and, you know, I'm going to do what I used to do and all that stuff. I get down to the beach, my favorite spot, and I go out and it's like, it's cold out here. Is that a shark? Or, you know, it's like,
I do stuff like that all the time. It just, you want to relive things from 40 years ago and it just doesn't translate the same way.
It's done. Everything dies. Everything changes. And all works in progress.
Right.
And it ain't over till it's over.
Right. That's right.
You know?
That's right.
It's just, I mean, you know, every time I look at that picture of the Rat Pack, you know, I'm thinking to myself, those guys ruled the fucking world.
Absolutely.
They ruled it.
They were gods.
You know, in many ways,
they were gods. They were the gods of their time. They were the Jimmy 100%. Pages and the Robert Plants of their time.
Well, especially, if, you know, guys like you and me from the background, it's the same thing. They were a little bit more than idols. You know, I mean it. I remember my Aunt Mary going, come on, Frankie, please, you know,
I know.
It's just remarkable. And, but they, you know, look at what they were doing. They were creating a landscape of a certain image. You know, maybe they were assholes too. Who fucking knows? You know, didn't sound like they were the nicest guys from time to time.
No. Oh, no, I don't think that. Sammy Davis definitely wasn't. I know a lot about, you know, read books about Sammy Davis. He was definitely not a nice guy. I mean, he came off that way on TV, but he was
the persona,
pretty,
yeah.
Yeah, he was pretty mean to a lot of women, like real mean.
I think that's why I fell in love with the Tony Cardone thing, is that I could become somebody else, you know. I could touch base on something that was a part of my life that I wish I was a little bit more a part of, you know.
Right.
Because in many ways, it's an imitation. When I go into the New York mentality and the New York state of mind, if you will, or the back east is basically what it is. It's in me, but it's not me. Mm. You know, it comes out more when I talk to Goombas like you, and mm-hmm. it's the way it is, right? But for the most part, I'm just this, you know, weird kid from California that got thrown all over the place from a very broken home, a very abusive childhood, tragic, really. My background story is tragic. And it's something I guess I've been running from for many years. And this persona, this guy can handle it.
Right.
But, you know. I'm just creating another character to deal with it. That's just the reality of it. Mm. That's pretty heavy shit.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. It's good. Sorry about that. Good way to end things. Did you anything that you wanted to add in?
I could end it on that note.
You can end it on that note.
Tom, on that positive, on that uplifting note.
Positive, uplifting note. Right.
See you, everyone.
Well, Tommy, I mean, Tom and I.
And we never heard from him again.
we appreciate these cool stories, and maybe not so cool stories at some point, but you know, it was all good.
You think you met somebody who could talk, right? Yeah. I know I talked like a freaking
you and Josh,
let me out of my cage right from there, time to time.
you and Josh, right? You're right up there.
Oh, yeah. Well, can you imagine the both of us in the same room?
I had said that to Mark. Since we had all three, I should have had all three of you guys on at the same time with Sean.
That would be a blast.
Because we had all three of you on different shows.
We got to make that happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
The LRS reunion.
That might be the best rated show we have if we get the three of you.
Honestly, seriously, though, thank you so much for reaching out. I appreciate it. It's nice to be known from time to time, you know. And I appreciate your guys'
I'll let you know something. This is God's honest truth. I mean, Mark will tell me if I'm wrong. I only go after the guys that I sincerely loved as artists, because if I can't do this and have like a real enjoyment, I'm not going to bring on people that I'm was like lukewarm on, or I only try to weed out the guys that I really liked a lot. So, you know, it's
I'm taking off the douchebag glasses, and I'm saying, thank you, my friend.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure, and thanks for doing it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks both of you guys. Okay. Take care, you guys.
All right.
Take care, Tommy. Thanks, Tom.
Stay warm.
Take
have care. A great day.
Bye, bye, brother.
Take care. Bye. Longest night, how can I say it will be all right now? But I find a way. These eyes can't cry. I've seen it all before. My love, tears gone. I've got to find an open door. Patiently. Oh,
playing.